Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 20th, 1998. In the fireside room this evening is Roberta Bondi. Today's session number is 98-1, and it is titled Sayings from the Desert, Introduction. Let's listen in.
So, I'm Roberta Bondi, and I am presenting the material for this period of time. And I don't know whether y'all usually tell each you all is what we say in the South. That's the plural of you. I don't know whether you all usually give your names to each other or whether ever you know each other. Okay, well, we won't do that. This probably take the whole time, wouldn't it? Okay. So we won't do this. Well, I'll tell you a little bit about myself to introduce, to get into this material, because I think that's important. I teach at Candler School of Theology, which is the biggest Methodist seminary that we have in Atlanta, Georgia. It's at Emory University. And what I teach is the early church and also narrative theology and stuff like that. But spirituality is one of my big issues, and particularly the intersection of theology and spirituality. Because I am convinced that there is no way to think about God or to pray or to relate to God without drawing on deep-seated images that we already bring to what we're about. And so that spirituality and theology are a kind of bringing together an intersection of personal experience, tradition, scripture, thinking, and that they all come together, and you can't do without all of those. So everything I do is sort of aimed at figuring out how to get at that so that we can bring the whole of who we are into conversation with God and with our fellow Christians in the body of Christ. So that's one chunk. Now let me tell you a little bit about my childhood. I grew up in a family in which religion wasn't much talked about, because I had a Yankee father who was very cynical and not very, he was very cynical about religion and all its aspects, but particularly ministers. And my mother grew up in Southern Baptist little church in Union County, Kentucky, and very religious. But she also believed that women must obey their husbands and should not upset their husbands in any way. And so there was no way to talk about religion in the household from her perspective. Now, what she did with the children was she brought us to Sunday school and dropped us off at various Sunday schools where we lived in my childhood. But then also the big bang was we would go to visit my grandparents in Union County every summer during summer revival. Pine Fork Baptist Church. Yes. So Pine Fork Baptist Church summer revivals contributed heavily to my religious education as a child. And every summer the preaching was the same. And, you know, no matter what the topic was, it was the same. The point was to move toward conversion, you know, to get people to have conversion experiences. And so the preaching always would go on and on and on, emphasize, you know, you're all sinners, you're all going to hell, so forth and so on. And then it would culminate in, this is not an exact quote, but it's the idea, only believe God loves you or he'll send you to hell forever. And I found that a very convincing message. At least the sending me to hell forever part. I couldn't believe God loved me, but I did definitely believe that God would send me to hell forever for not believing that God loved me. So I ended up with a sort of complex love-hate relationship to Christianity and to God through my growing up years. That largely was affected by that, was also affected by the fact that I had a very strict father who put a lot of obedience on perfection. And my parents married young, he didn't really understand that children can't do the things adults can, you know, in the same degree that adults can, you know. If a grown-up can make a model airplane out of wood and put four coats of paint on it and sand it in between, he didn't understand why a four-year-old little boy couldn't do it. And so this attitude of my father played in, intersected very nicely with what I heard about this God in Kentucky. On top of that, I had back then in the 40s and then later in the 50s, was not just the world's greatest time to be female. and from the larger culture and then also from my parents. You know, I was supposed to tell them that they were supposed to be taping me, and I didn't tell them to turn the tape on.
I bet they figured it out.
I hope they figured it out, because it would be terrible if I should be so irresponsible as
Oh! Your father's not here.
But God is here. I have no idea. I have no idea.
They will.
They pick it up. Okay. All right. That's good.
You spoke your name. That's
I spoke my name. Okay. That's good. Okay. I spoke my name. Anyway, all of those things contributed to an unsuccessful and an unhappy experience of Christianity in my growing up years. Now, I had lots of good stuff, too, but that was basically, I came out of adolescence with that. And I noticed that there's, you know, that what we have here is, you know, the larger culture, theological statements that were made at the revival, a kind of spirituality, family experiences, all of those things coming together. Okay, now how did I ever manage to become a Christian theologian? This looks like an impossible sort of thing, but I'll tell you one more thing about the Baptist revivals when I would go. They also always ran concurrently with Vacation Bible School. And in Vacation Bible School, which I just adored, the main thing that we learned were Old Testament stories. And the Old Testament stories I just loved, because the God that I met in the Old Testament stories was a God who seemed to me to be always out rescuing children, you know, rescuing Jacob from Abraham and Ruth. I thought of Ruth as a little girl, even though she wasn't. But God was always rescuing somebody in the New Testament, in the Old Testament. Now, in the New Testament, God was always warning, and Jesus was warning people that they were about to be cast into outer darkness. So I'm one of those few people, come in. I'm one of those few people who experienced, I guess, growing up, that the God of the Old Testament was the God of love, but the God of the New Testament was the God of wrath. And so I started graduate work in Old Testament. But I also had to do Syriac as another language, which is, I was doing Hebrew and Aramaic. And Syriac. Syriac is another version of Aramaic, the Christian version of Aramaic. And when I got time to do my dissertation, I committed myself to do it in Syriac before I realized that all the material extant from the early church was Christian. This was a bad shock to the system when I found it out. And I had many miserable weeks in the Bodleian Library in Oxford looking for a dissertation topic, going through book after book of this early Christian stuff. And the one thing I could hear in the Christian material, it wasn't true, but it was all I could hear, was Brother Smith at the revival. You know, it just sounded like the same stuff over and over. And I thought, what have I done with my life? You know, I'm committed to spend my life with this. And then one day when things got so bad I thought I was going to probably die, I was sitting in the library in October, and it was cold and miserable and there was never enough light. And I picked a book off the top of my stack, and it had the wonderful, attractive title of The 13 Ascetical Homilies of Philoxenus of Mabug. It makes you just drool to hear it. So I picked this up, and I just opened it in the middle at random, and it was a sermon on written in the 6th century, to monks, telling them why it is that they should not judge each other. And the reason why they should not judge each other, this homily said, was because they are to model themselves on God, who always looks at human beings with far more compassion than we ever look at ourselves. Now, this may not sound like much to you, but for me, this was such a revolutionary idea. You know, it was like my breath was knocked out. I thought, God looks at us more compassionately than we look at ourselves. God does not judge us the way, you know, I thought, if this is true, nothing in life is like I thought it was. Everything is different. And I resolved at that point that these were the people I wanted to work on. I wanted to work on this early monastic literature. And that's, in fact, and I had to take a detour for my dissertation because this literature was not regarded as seriously academic enough back in those days, though it is now. So I did my dissertation on another aspect of Philoxenus's thought. But then I rushed back to the early monastic material. And I have, in fact, found that they really are as liberating and as wonderful as that first 15-second exposure to them, that they have, in fact, changed my life, and that they have a huge amount to offer, I think, to modern Christians who are struggling with not just that particular issue, but a lot of other issues also that we struggle with. So what I would like to do now that I've told you a little bit of why I think they're important, is to tell you a little bit of who they were. So we won't talk much about their theology tonight, but they're interesting enough that you will want to know, I think, who they were. Now, one thing I have to tell you, whenever I teach, I just assume that people, when they have questions, will ask their questions. Just interrupt me, and if it's something I'm going to say later, I'll say, well, if you can just wait a little bit, we'll get to it later. And if you feel like, if I don't know now, I'm going to die, you can say, if I don't know that now, I'll die. And I'll say, well, maybe we better answer it now. But anyway, just ask your questions when they come up. And we'll also, if you don't ask questions, we'll have a period for discussion later. Okay? Okay, who were these people? Well, the first thing I want to say about who these people were is that they're our Christian ancestors. Now, one of the terrible legacies of the Reformation is that Protestants have tended to think, well, there are two churches. There's the Catholic Church and there's the Protestant Church, and everything that happened before the Reformation belongs to the Catholic Church. The fact is that that's not the case. These are our common ancestors from the period of the church split. So these people belong to us. These are not them. These people are us. That's the first thing to say, that we are all one in the body of Christ, and these are the sort of the backbone of the body as far as I'm concerned. Okay, now in the Constantine, you probably remember running into at some point, not personally, but his memory, became emperor in the 4th century. And up until that period of time, when Constantine became emperor, it was illegal to be Christian. And sometimes it was very dangerous to be Christian, and there were long periods of time when it was not dangerous to be Christian. But Christians always remembered in that period that it was not legal to be Christian, and that being Christian was a dangerous enterprise. Now, when Constantine became emperor, things changed because Christianity became the favored religion of Constantine and the empire. And all of a sudden, if you wanted to get in good with the emperor and do well in government, you became Christian. Now, this clearly put a different spin on what it meant to be Christian. Instead of knowing when you became Christian it was going to cost you something, maybe, and what it might cost you is your life, suddenly it went completely the opposite, in the opposite direction. And so when you read texts from the 3rd century and the 4th century, you can tell that this is a really different thought world. Now, it used to be said that monasticism was the outgrowth of the fact that it was now legal to be Christian, and that there were a lot of people in the empire who looked around and said, "This is too easy. This isn't what we were called to. We were called to something radical," and so monasticism grew out of it. The only trouble with that theory is that monasticism got its start in the 3rd century. and probably even in the 2nd century. But there's still some truth to it. I mean, that's one of those stories that there is some truth to it. Because the founders of Egyptian monasticism, now, monasticism did not really begin in Egypt, but that's part of the myth of the ancient church, was that ancient people like to think of monasticism having its roots in Egypt. And Assyrians did stuff like that for a long time before that. And there are different places in the empire where that was that kind of practices were going on. But Anthony is the name that we associate with the beginnings of male Egyptian monasticism. And he was, you know, you can date him right about in the middle of the 3rd century. He was a 18-year-old young man, son of wealthy peasant parents, with a younger sister when his parents died, and he was left with all of this property and the care of his younger sister. And he had been raised Christian himself. We know this because there's a biography, a 4th century biography of him, Athanasius, which is easy to get a hold of. I always use it in my classes. It's fascinating reading. But it tells the story of Anthony. So Anthony's parents died, and he was left with this money and his sister. And he went to church about 6 months after his parents died, and he did all this inheriting. And the gospel for that Sunday was the story of the rich young ruler. So few would be perfect. So all you have, come follow me. So Anthony heard this in church, and he said, "I'm rich, I'm young, I'm an important person in this town. This is for me. This is Jesus is speaking to me." So he sold a whole bunch of his property and gave it away, gave away the proceeds, and moved into a little hut on the back of his property. And then it says he started going around visiting all the old men in the neighborhood who were already living ascetic lives. Now, the word ascetic means, it's asceticism in its original meaning was the training of an athlete. The ascesis is the training, the discipline of an athlete. So men who were living ascetic lives, who were training in the various Christian virtues, that he went around and he visited them and he learned what he could. And then he went back to church, which was clearly a mistake at this point, and it said, "Take no thought for the morrow what you shall eat and what you shall drink." And so he sold off the rest of his stuff. Now here's the interesting detail. Here's an interesting detail in the story. At that point, it says, he put his sister in a household of virgin women in their care. Now, obviously, this one detail tells us there was already women's monasticism. But because of the attitude of the early church toward women, this wasn't really observed. Yes?
Is this in Italy or in Egypt?
No, this is in Egypt. I'm sorry. This is in a little town on the Nile in Egypt. Right. Should have made that clearer. So he puts little sister in the household of virgin women, and he starts his life in earnest. And first he spent 15 years living in the cemetery, the town cemetery, in a tomb. Now, you got to remember that in Egypt, they bury people above ground and not underground. So he was, you know, it was like a little hut. You might be saying, why on earth would he spend 15 years in a tomb? And that would be a good question, and I will now give you the answer to it. And that is because the tomb, the cemetery, see, if you remember the geography of Egypt, you know, you've got this fertile strip down the Nile, and then you have desert. Okay. Now, the cemetery was right there on the border between desert and the town. And the desert was where the demons lived and the forces of chaos, both metaphorically and actually in people's minds. And right up there, along with that, was death. Now, early Christians, early people in this period, whether they're Christian or not, didn't think that dying was a very good idea. They were not in favor of this. And in fact, if you read the early texts on Christian salvation, the effect of Christ defeating death is just incredibly central to the way they understand this. So Anthony moves out to the cemetery as a representative person who is, in his own way, going to take on the forces of chaos and destruction and the demonic and death for himself, but also it's significant that he does it in the town cemetery. He's doing it on behalf also of his town. Now here's something that's really important. I don't know about you all, but I was raised as my mother raised me to be able to distinguish the fact of Methodists and other Protestants from Catholics by the fact that Catholics have those monastics, and you know, they're completely only interested in their own salvation. Now, I don't know, was anybody else raised to think in those terms? Yeah, but monasticism, you're concerned with your own soul, and everybody else can go, you know, where. Okay, now, even if you didn't grow up with that, I think this is a misunderstanding often that Protestants carry to misunderstand the significance of even this very early monasticism as a social movement. There is a fact that is just fundamental here to get right off the bat if you're going to understand these things. That whatever the monastic is doing for himself or herself, it's also being done on behalf of the larger society. And the interesting thing is the way these people stood at the center of the imagination of their own age. You know, these people that we're going to be looking at this week were just incredibly powerful people in terms of the influence they had over their own culture. So Anthony lived there for 15 years, and then he had an interesting religious experience in which he wrestled the demons. And they knocked him out, and his friends dragged him to the local church because they thought he was dead. And then everybody went to sleep at the vigil, and Anthony woke up and said, "Oh, where am I? Where am I?" And he trotted back to his tomb and wrestled the demons some more until he finally defeated them. And then the ceiling opened in the tomb, and Jesus appeared to him. And then we have one of these great conversations of all through church history where Anthony's first words are, "Where have you been all this time?" Now, again, that's a slight paraphrase, but it's definitely what Anthony said. And Jesus said, "Well, I just wanted to see what you were going to do. But I promise I'll be with you forever. From this point on, I'll be with you." But it is one of my favorite scenes from ancient monastic literature. So Anthony then goes out and he lives in the desert as a real hermit. Now, while he's in the cemetery, he's obviously having a lot of social interaction. But he lives as a real hermit then from the time he's 35 till he's about 50 in an abandoned fort in the real desert. And at the end of that time, crowds of people come out to see Anthony come out. And he comes out, and everyone is astounded by, as Athanasius says, the fact that he was neither too fat nor too thin, and that he was in great physical health and muscular condition, like as though he had been exercising all those years, and that his emotions are perfectly balanced. Now, see, again, the interesting thing is the symbolic statement that that's making, because it also goes on to say he was like Adam before the fall. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the goals in this early free-spirited monasticism was the goal of the restoration of the image of God as it had originally belonged to Adam and Eve. And if you keep that in mind, it makes sense of a lot of odd behavior on their part. Okay, so Anthony then lived to be, he came out then at that point, and then from that point on, he alternates between being completely by himself out in the desert for a few months, and then he comes in and he's available to everybody all the time. And then he alternates between being by himself and being with people. And meanwhile, his reputation is growing, and he's becoming more and more of a powerful figure. Now, when Anthony came out of that tomb, it was only at the right at the middle of his life, because he lived to be 105 years old. And it's amazing how old some of these people managed to get. One of my favorite sets of dates from the early church is Jacob of Sarug, who lived from 399 to 502. He managed to live in at least a little bit of three different centuries. Okay. So Athanasius said he was 105 when he died, and Athanasius said he was in perfect physical condition except for one fact: his teeth were worn all the way down to the gums. The reason why his teeth were worn all the way down to the gums was that the early monastic teachers, like Anthony and those who came to settle around him, because that's what happened, little communities formed around him with monastic teachers and their disciples. But the common diet in the north of Egypt, which is where he was, there were communities in the south of Egypt where they ate a little differently, but was pretty much grain and water with a few vegetables. And the grain would be ground in a mortar and pestle. And by the time you got to be 105 years old, you'd had a lot of grit ground up into your grain, which has been turned into bread, you know, little cakes of bread. And your teeth wore down. I thought you might want to know why Anthony's teeth wore down. Okay. So Anthony then died at 105, and by the time he died, there were just tons of communities out in the Egyptian desert that followed this pattern. Now, let me tell you a little bit about these communities. All of them had in common, as I am convinced, Anthony's original vision of following Jesus. And perfection was in that goal, but it was not perfection as the list on the refrigerator door, check it off before you go to bed sort of perfection, but perfection in love. The attempt was to grow in perfect love of God and neighbor, to live out the Great Commandment. Now that's what they had in common, and they had some other things in common too, in the way they lived. But what would happen is that one man, and I have to tell you that most of the people in the desert were men. Women took up the monastic life, but they were not so much in the desert. And their writings were not preserved in the same way that men's were. It's very, very sad. Because there are three women whose sayings are preserved in the sayings, in the document called the Sayings of the Desert Fathers. And they're very interesting. Short, but interesting. But it's very sad that more is not preserved from the women. Now, that doesn't keep the male writer's material from being very liberating. I mean, I really do feel as though my strongest impetus to get brave enough in back in the 70s and 80s to embrace a really feminist vision of Christian life came from these writers. They were the ones who stood behind me always saying, Roberta, take the risk, go ahead and do it. You know, in Christ there's neither male nor female, slave nor free. So it's terrible that we don't have more women writers whose works survive. Nevertheless, we also have a strong resource here for liberation of all sorts, human liberation, Christian liberation. Okay, so what would happen is that a man would decide that he wanted to take up this kind of a life. This was in the original generations, three generations or so. And he would go out in the desert and he would establish his own discipline. Now, there was a huge amount of variety among these first teachers. Yes.
Do we know enough about these people to know if the pattern that Anthony shows us was common in that he was raised as a Christian?
Now, could you ask that question again?
Well, Anthony was raised as a Christian.
We know he was raised as a Christian.
Is that the common pattern that monastics are people who are second-generation Christians? I know that there are contrary stories.
Yeah, okay, well, but the founder of the kind of monasticism that grew up in the south of Egypt was named Pachomius, and he's also famous, too, because Pachomius founded huge communities, you know, where there would literally be thousands of people. And his conversion experience to the monastic life, this is also an interesting and good story. He was raised as a pagan, and he was, a few years after Anthony, he was conscripted into the Roman army. Now, conscription into the army in those days meant a bunch of soldiers came and dragged you away in chains and put you in jail and then sent you off to fight. So he is conscripted like that in the army and put in a tower, a deserted tower with other conscripts on an island in the Nile without food or water or clothing, warm clothing. And while he was there, a group of people came and brought food and warm clothes and water for the conscripts, just, you know, as an act of compassion. And he said, "Who are those people?" And he was told, "Oh, well, those are Christians." And so he prayed a prayer that also is preserved, where he prays to this unknown God and says, "God, if you will rescue me from this place, I will leave here and serve all human beings." And so he then becomes the founder of monasticism in the south of Egypt. And when he got started, he almost certainly wouldn't have known about Anthony. But no, I would say huge numbers weren't raised Christian. So a man would come out and he would establish his own discipline and his own way of life in the desert, and then other men would hear about him, and they would go and say, "Can I live with you and learn your ways?" And he would say, either no way or, "Well, yeah, if you want to," or, "Yeah, that sounds like a good idea." And so the little communities formed, and some of them were just a teacher and a couple of disciples. Some of them originally were got to be pretty big, you know, a couple hundred people with a teacher. Now, the teacher was called the Abba, which means father in Coptic. And the women teachers were called Ammas and Amma. I'm happy to tell you that I still get pleasure out of the fact that my great grandmother was named Amma, in fact. Mm-hmm. This is just always seemed like a sort of blessed coincidence. Anyway, so then, but the communities were different from each other according to the discipline of the Abba, who would set the tone and sort of set the rule for that particular community. Now, let me tell you what else they have in common before we look at some differences. All of them were based in prayer. The goal, a major goal within this life, was to live a life of prayer. And in Egypt, this was a kind of, the goal was that it be a kind of continuum of prayer. Now, in Palestine, where monasticism caught on, or close to the same time, they prayed according to the liturgical hours, pretty much right from the beginning. But they did not do that in Egypt. Now, the kind of prayer they prayed was basically the Psalms. It was quite common for, probably almost all of the early monastics, I imagine, knew the Psalms by heart. A lot of them were illiterate. Most of them would have been illiterate. And books were very expensive. And, I mean, really, really expensive and hard to come by. And so people had the Psalms memorized. Now, that in itself has always seemed to me a pretty big feat, you know, all 150 Psalms, you know, added through. And a really diligent prayer could go through the Psalms in 24 hours. Again, that's a pretty big feat. So their prayer was based in the Psalms. That was the basic thing. The practice of prayer, the way people prayed in those days, and not just Christians, but also pagans, was they prayed standing up. They did not kneel. And they prayed with their arms out. So when you read that a teacher like Arsenius, an Abba like Arsenius, would customarily pray all night, pray the Psalms all night, we're talking about praying standing. This is an athletic feat. You know, again, we're not, when we hear the word asceticism associated with these people, that sense of athletic training discipline is not completely lost. So Arsenius was said to start praying at sundown and pray till the sun came up in his face the next morning. Commonly. Okay. Customarily, as far as I know, all of the desert fathers and mothers in Egypt cut the kinds of ties with their families where they were obligated in any way with respect to their families. Now, they were celibate, and it was not uncommon for men to leave their families to go take up this life. Though there are also stories that make it clear that they still managed to provide in some way for their families. But they were celibate, and there were all sorts of reasons for the celibacy, both theological and practical. I just will point out something quickly that you probably already realize, and that is that that there was no equality in marriage in those days. The assumption was that a man would marry in his 30s, and he would, well, you remember Augustine of Hippo, the great early church father. Yes, you may know him under the name of Augustine. He goes by both names, a.k.a. Augustine. And anyway, when he became engaged as a man in his 30s, he was engaged to a woman who was 2 years below the legal age to get married. And the legal age to get married was 12. He was engaged to a 10-year-old. Now, clearly, in a situation like that, marriage is not about companionship. You know. So, you know, we've got a totally different kind of model of what marriage was when people say we don't want that. You know, it was something where the man had almost all the power, the woman had very little power, and no companion, you know, not, it wasn't a marriage of equality at all. The whole culture had what we would think of as really serious hang-ups about sex, too. This was not a Christian thing alone. The whole culture had just major problems with this. The other thing, the theological reason for suspecting or disliking sex was, again, it's linked with death. The way the story was told of creation, and we can see this from Irenaeus in the second century on, is that that God created Adam and Eve, put them in the Garden of Eden, and gave them the gift of immortality. But, of course, we know they blew it. And as a result of them blowing it, they then became mortal. As Gregory of Nyssa says in the 4th century, then God gave the gift of marriage to counteract mortality. And what he meant by that was that people would get married and have children. And instead of having the kind of immortality they were meant to have in the first place, they would have a kind of immortality through their children. Okay. So marriage then is definitely going to be second rate, as they understood it, because it's about having children, and you wouldn't have to have children if we just stayed the way we were supposed to stay in the first place. Okay. So this is, again, notice this theme of back to the original creation. And there were other difficulties with that too, which we can talk about at other times. I want to make sure we got a little time for discussion. Okay, what they ate. Basically, they were vegetarians. We already know about Anthony and his teeth, but they were basically vegetarians. And again, the point of being a vegetarian, the practical reason for being a vegetarian was that they were very poor. They didn't have any money. And most people didn't eat very much in the way of meat anyway, you know, because most people couldn't afford it. And certainly they couldn't afford it once they took up this life. The theological reason for it was that Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden were on good terms with the animals. You didn't eat your friends. And so there are some delightful stories that survived from the early church about the monastics and animals. My favorite one being of a Syrian monk who was visited by an out-of-state visitor one time, who spent the day talking with the monk and having a good time. And then at bedtime, he was sent off to one cave, and the teacher that he went to visit went off to his own cave. And it was cold weather. And the visitor just practically froze to death. He got up the next morning, he was all blue, and his teeth were chattering, and he was pathetic and hungry and miserable. And the monk that he was visiting was all pink and warm and fat and happy. So the visitor said, "Well, you know, why are you so, warm when I'm freezing to death?" And he said, "Oh, I have a lion who comes in and sleeps with me every night." I've always been so jealous of that. I love the idea of having a lion that comes in that warms you up. But again, that's the theme, both of looking back to Adam and Eve before the fall and looking ahead to living out the promises of the new creation. Okay, so that's food. They lived lives of poverty. They didn't own property in the north of Egypt. Another one of my favorite sayings is a disciple went up to his Abba one time and said, "Is it okay if I have a second set of clothes?" And the Abba said, "Your cloak should be such that you can throw it out your front door and no one would steal it for 3 days." Okay, work. They tended to do work that took little brain so that they could spend a lot of time thinking about the things they wanted to think about and praying. And so they did things like making baskets and weaving rush mats and sandals. Those were making sandals. Those were three popular things to do in the north of Egypt. In the south, in the big communities, they also wove and did lots of other things too. But in the north of Egypt, they're into that kind of stuff. And there are nice stories about one Abba comes to visit another, and they're both working on their baskets, and and while they talk, and the baskets get so big and they're not paying attention. You know, they're just they get so big they can't get them out of the door. They have to undo them again so they can get them out. That's nice. Okay, now for just a little bit about who, where these people came from. They're coming from all over the Roman Empire. There's a large contingent of Coptic monks. Now, the Copts were the peasant class who spoke a form of Egyptian that was like ancient Egyptian, but the more modern, up-to-date version of it. A lot of them were Coptic peasants. Most of those were illiterate and came from very impoverished backgrounds. There's a whole group of those monks. But then there are also people who come from aristocratic backgrounds and sort of what we think of now as middle class or artisan backgrounds. Arsenius was one of the best known of the fathers who came from a aristocratic background, and he had been actually the tutor of the son of the emperor before he took up this life, but also he owned all sorts of property, many different estates, and the texts say lots of slaves, and was an important person in court. Now, the discipline that he took up when he came to the desert was basically one of silence. He was a stern man, known for his sternness and his unbendingness with respect to himself, but also often with other people too. If you went in and you didn't like Arsenius, this didn't bother Arsenius in the slightest. Now, his best friend in the stories was a tall black man from the Sudan whose name was Moses. And Moses seems like the exact opposite of Arsenius in every way you can think of, because he was uneducated. Where Arsenius was living in court, what Moses did for a living, he was a highway robber. So he would lay in wait for wayfarers, for travelers, and rob them and murder them. And so Moses came to this life, and Arsenius came to this life, and they're close friends. And it obviously tickled the imagination of a lot of the people who lived there, as well as people who would come to visit them, because where Arsenius's discipline was silence, Moses's was hospitality. And I didn't understand this for a long time. I didn't, it seemed like a sort of arbitrary, so one likes one and one likes the other, that's nice, but it occurred to me one day that what each of them has done is to take up a discipline that directly addresses the issues and problems that would have governed their lives in their former life. So Arsenius was somebody who had people sucking up to him all over the place, and flattering him and telling him how wonderful he was and asking him for favors and so forth. And the discipline he takes up then is, the Archbishop of Alexandria came to see him one day, Theophilus. And it was hard even then for the Archbishop to get to see him, because he would put on disguises, and Arsenius put on disguises. But he finally caught up with him, and Theophilus says, "Oh, please see me, Arsenius." And he says, "Well, I'll let you look at me if you promise to do whatever I say." And Theophilus says, okay. He says, "All right, here I am. Now, never come back here again, ever." This is not the way you talk to the most powerful person in Egypt, which is politically powerful as well as powerful in the church. So Theophilus then doesn't come back. Yes?
Sounds like there's really no connection here between these ascetics and the formal church.
Huh? Oh, but there was.
They're not ordained, or they're not.
Oh no, that's right. They were not ordained. Yeah. Let me tell you a little bit about Moses, and then I'll answer that, because that's really an important question: the connection between the church and who these people were. Now, Moses, as I said, his former life was as a highway robber. And so for him to adopt hospitality, the care of visitors, is just a wonderful counteraction to that life that he had led before. Now, I'm not forgetting your question. I've got to tell you one story about Moses and Arsenius. And they were, as I said, famous in the ancient desert for their opposite dispositions, but the fact that they really were close friends. So one day, a visitor from far away came to the desert, and the desert was apparently full of visitors coming from, with lay people and also monks from other places, coming to learn from these teachers. So this visitor comes to the community where Arsenius is, and a local priest, or brother, picks him up, and the visitor says, "I'd like to go see Arsenius." So the brother and the visitor go to Arsenius's cell, which is what they called the little huts where the teachers lived. And they went in and they sat down. Now, with the proper etiquette when you visited a monastic teacher was you went and sat and you let them speak first. You didn't go in and speak. You waited until they spoke. Well, Arsenius just ignored them. You know, he never said anything to them. You know, and they sat there and they sat there and they sat there. And finally, the visitor's getting more and more uncomfortable and nervous, and he says, to the brother, take me to see Abba Moses, who used to be a robber. So they get up and they go, and of course Moses is so happy to see the visitor. And the brother who's been the guide is puzzling over this. And he prays to God and he says, "Explain to me how this can be, that these people can be so different from each other and yet still be monastics." And the story says he was shown a vision of a lake with two boats on it. And in one of the boats was Moses, and the other was with Arsenius. And Arsenius was sailing in the boat peacefully and calmly conversing with the Trinity. And in the other boat was Moses, and the boat was full of angels, and they were all eating honey cakes. Now, the purpose of that story is to talk about the fact that people are genuinely different from each other. And whatever your issue is that you're working on, it's going to take a different discipline. We have a hard time with it. You know, we talk a lot about diversity, but we don't believe it. You know, now these people really do believe it, and a lot of these stories are meant to really to encourage us to take ourselves seriously, and to take our differences from each other seriously, and to take our differences in different parts of our own lives seriously from time to time. Now back to that question about the church. Athanasius, who was the one who wrote the life of St. Anthony originally, was the probably the most famous archbishop in Egypt in the 4th century, the Archbishop of Alexandria. And he was... That was a time of great controversy in the church, and the one party to which Athanasius belonged was in constant controversy and political unrest with opponents who were also Christian but who were called Arians. That's not with a Y, that's an I-A-N, no connection. But the way things went was that every time the Arians had the upper hand, and this would generally be because there was an Arian emperor, the Orthodox party would all the priests and bishops and archbishops would be thrown out of their job and sent into exile, and then there would be Arians, and then the Arians would get overthrown, and then there would be Orthodox. And Athanasius was in exile 7 times during his life. And for a good many of those periods, he went and he hid in the desert with the monks. So that Athanasius was, from the beginning, an advocate of the monks. And I think it was very significant for keeping the monks in the church, Athanasius' involvement at that point. The first generations of monks were not ordained. In fact, this was a lay movement. And Pacomius, who was the one, you know, that I told you founded Southern monasticism, explicitly in his the first life of Pacomius that exists, has Pacomius being quoted as saying, we won't have priests in this community, they just get in here and boss everybody around. You know, and so, we're, you know, what we're about here is a kind of radical equality and we can't afford priests. But in fact, what happened is that the communities grew larger and they needed priests, and they, so they started finally ordaining monks to the priesthood. But also in the Egyptian countryside, the monastics would often serve as kind of informal priests for the villagers in places where they didn't have priests. And there are a lot of stories from the 4th through the 6th century that indicate a kind of jealousy that was going on between the sort of the spiritual power and authority that the monastics often had over against the priests of the local community. But the monastics stayed in the church, and by the end of the 4th century, they started becoming the big pool from which bishops were drawn. And it has been argued, and I think probably rightly, that one reason that that you ended up in the early church with a celibate clergy was under that influence of so many clergymen being drawn from the ranks of monasticism by the 5th century. But it's a very important connection, because they definitely stayed in the church. But there was this, you have Isaac of Nineveh in the 7th century, he belonged to a third party in the church, but he says explicitly that in his writings that he was a monastic and then he was made bishop. But he left it because, it says, he repented. So it's a complex relationship, but an important one. Yes?
What was it you said there was, rather than being isolated, that the early desert Pavism always had a tremendous appeal among the general population? Was it this kind of trying to go back to the purity of almost the creation?
Well,
what made them so attractive? It's,
you'll have to come to the other days this week. I think for one reason, I think probably they appealed a lot for the same reason they first appealed to me, that they seem to be people who are people of enormous inner strength and who were able to live out what they professed, and who had an enormous influence on people just by being able to live out what they professed. And what they professed was love. You know, so, for example, this theme that I originally met in them about the importance of avoiding judgment on other people, I mean, that's probably, by accident or by grace, you know, I encountered this a central reality in that material, and I think it had a tremendous appeal. Yes.
This is probably a question you can't answer quickly.
Two more minutes.
But when you ask that question about appeal, when I try and teach this material, the difficulty I always have is that maybe these people are preaching love and not judging others, but I have a difficult time conveying to my students that this isn't motivated by self-hatred.
Yeah, and it wasn't. It's absolutely not motivated. Tomorrow we're talking about love. And we will talk about love of God, love of neighbor, and love of self. And love of self, they really did understand to be of enormous importance. Because if you love your neighbor as yourself and you hate yourself, this doesn't say much for how you see it, does it? But the people are told over and over that what they need to learn to do, what we need to learn to do, is to love our own souls. And what they mean is to love ourselves. Now, that does not mean to them what we hear often, what, you know, this doesn't mean, therefore, go join a health club and take up pottery and leave your husband because your children are a drag. You know, this is not quite what they, you know, they don't mean the same thing quite that we mean. But tomorrow we'll be talking about their understanding of love. If that's the goal of the Christian life, what does that look like? And how do we get to it? Okay?
All right, thank you.
Thank you. These are really cool. Oh, and there's this book in the bookstore that looks like this. That is, in fact...